All right, we're starting here on the top of Peyamud Aleph, second line down. The Gemara left off with two possible suggestions as to how to read the Mishnah. The first of which was Shmuel's suggestion that the case here is a rotzeach shelo nigmar dino, shenitarei v'rotzchei macherim shenigmar dinam. That's one possibility that the Gemara posited. The second one was the suggestion of Reish Lakish that we're speaking about shvarim. That we're speaking about animals over here. And you have an shor niskal that got mixed up with other shvarim who have yet to be sentenced to death. Similar to the genre of what Shmuel said, he's just saying by shvarim and not by individuals. The question posited by Rava was the following. Even if my father, Abba Chalafta, was amongst them, that would be true. So now both Shmuel and Reish Lakish's positions are difficult in that light. Reish Lakish says we're speaking about animals, so what does it have to do with his father being amongst those individuals? Shmuel says they're rotschim, they're murderers. So then why would his father being amongst murderers, he's implying that his father's a murderer? Neither of those seem viable explanations in the face of the qualification that Rabbi Yossi makes of this Mishnah, or even if his father was amongst them. So now the Gemara says, Elam Arava, Hachi Gamar. This is the way to read the Mishnah. Shnaim shayu omdim, v'yatza chetz mibneihem. V'harag shneihem pturim. Two people were standing there, and an arrow shoots out from between them. You can read that one of two ways. Either they together shot the arrow, and then it becomes like Shnaim Shasu, which we saw 2 days ago on Daf Ayin Chet. The Rashi says, the Ish Kiyakeh Amar Rachmanu Velo Shnaim Shiko. That has to be a single individual that's responsible for the murder and not multiple people. Or the other way to read it simply is that the arrow shot out, there are two individuals there, we don't know which one of them shot it. We don't have evidence or a deem as to which of them in particular shot the arrow. They're both Patur Vam Rabbi Yossi, and Rabbi Yossi qualifies it and says, Afilo Abba Chalafta Bnehem. Even if my father, Abba Chalafta, was one of those two individuals, we still would not be able to prosecute the other individual. The assumption being that his father, Abba Chalafta, is a tzaddik, and he wouldn't do something like this. So, obviously, it's the other party that did it. Nevertheless, we can't prosecute based on that. Question is, why not? If Abba Chalafta has a chazokah as being a kasher, why isn't that enough to then incriminate the other individual? The answer being that his chazokah impacts the other individual. It's one thing to say that a person has a chezkat kashrut. It's another thing to say that a person has a chezkat kashrut at the expense of the other party, implying that the other party doesn't have a chezkat kashrut. So there you can't say there's a chazaka. The other person might have a chazaka as a kasher as well. So you can't take his chezkat kashrut and override the chezkat kashrut of the other individual. Therefore, both parties are pturim, because we just don't know who shot it. And since we don't know who shot it, you can't prosecute, we can't incriminate in this case. Then, v'shor shenigmar dino. So basically, as Rashi notes over here, you have a chesurei mechsera. The Mishnah was missing some wording or some phrasing over here. The first statement of the Mishnah is this concept of shnaim she'omdim v'yatza chetz mibneihem v'harag shneihem pturim. That's the first piece of the Mishnah. Then, shor shenigmar dino shnitarei b'shvarim acherim ma'alyo. If you have a shor that has a gemar din that's mixed up with other shvarim, they are totally fine. I mean, these are shvarim that have no incriminating evidence against them. So klimotam, we soak out, we give skila to all of them. Now, first of all, they're all asurim ba'ana now, because you have a tarovet of a shor sheniskal, which is asur ba'ana, and then you have other shvarim there that are kasher or totally fine, but you don't know which one is the shor niskal. And the shor niskal is going to make the entire group asurim anyway. So ben kach, you can't utilize these shvarim. The only question is, what are you going to do with them? So here we say, be sokel them, stone them, because you'll get at least one of them right. If you stone them, then at least one of those shvarim deserves skila, and Beit Din carry out its obligation to stone the animal by stoning all of them. So that way, miman of shach, you end up getting what you needed, which is stoning this one particular animal. The other animals were asurim ba'ana'a, so it wouldn't matter, you're not gaining anything from those other animals, you couldn't do anything with them anyway, so you may as well stone them so you get the desired result that Beit Din wants. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, konsino to the kippah. That Rabbi Yehuda says that the better way to deal with this is put them into the kippah. Again, we discussed yesterday, Rashi, the Adromo, speak about kippah being locked up in a tight stall, feeding them certain types of food, something that leads to eventual death. The Rambam, on the other hand, when he speaks about kippah, at least with human beings, just speaks about incarceration in general, just locking them up. But what Rabbi Huda is saying is, why bother Beit Din? You're putting Beit Din through a lot of trouble to have to stone 30, 40, whatever it is, shvarim that got mixed up over here. Why bother? Just get rid of the shvarim. That's the main issue, is v'yartai rab mikir becha. We want you to eliminate this shore. So if you do it in a way that is more efficient or easier for Beit Din, why not do it that way? Why do you force Beit Din to stone all these shvarim in order to accomplish what we need? We could do it without stoning. That's Rabbi Huda's view. There's a requirement to Beit Din eliminate the ra mikir becha. That obligation of Beit Din to eliminate the shore that killed someone allows you then to kill all the other shvarim because they're asurim b'hana anyway. Again, Tzar Bali Chaim won't be a factor if you're doing something that has a toelet, which is here you're doing v'yarta rami kirbecha. We won't consider Tzar Bali Chaim in those situations. But yes, this is the din with regards to animals, because ben kachu ben kach they're asurim b'hana. When it comes to human beings, you can't make that decision. You can't say, well, one of these guys deserves to die, which is collateral damage to the remainder of the individuals that are there. So this is a unique din that is associated with behemot. And that's why Rabbi Yehuda specifically requires consino to the kippah instead of just quickly killing them off so that there is no tzar balei chayim and that you don't have to waste all that effort and time in putting them to death, is because lo lak klufei be'adam. So you don't mix them up with human beings because the din is unique to animals. And the same din would not be applicable to human beings. We also discussed yesterday about whether the shor niskal is a sur ba'ana'a while it's still alive. The Rabbeinu Tam had this shita that it's mutar ba'ana'a while it's alive. It's only once it's dead it becomes a sur ba'ana'a, which means that you could benefit from the giza, the avoda, and all the other things of these animals until they needed to die. But the Baalei Tosfot themselves rejected that view of the Rabbeinu Tam and feel like they're a surim ba'ana'a from the moment that there is a verdict that this is a shor haniskal. Where it says, V'atanyo b'nichuta, Rashi points out, this is a braita that supports what we're suggesting over here. Para she'emita v'achar kach yelda, a para that killed and then gives birth. Imad shelo nigmar dina yelda, if before the verdict was reached, it gave birth, v'lada mutar, then the offspring is mutar. Imishing nardina, once it's the verdict has been determined, yalda, then it gave birth, vlada asur, then the offspring is asur. Nitarei v'acherim, v'acherim v'acherim, if it was mixed up with others, and others with others, konsin oto, the kippah, then they all go into the kippah, that's like Shita Rabbi Yehuda. Tosfot over here, unlike other places in Shas, is comfortable with the Gemara statement over here, that the mix-up was the v'acherim, v'acherim, v'acherim. And Tosfot says, even though there are two sfeikot now, the first mix-up, and then the second mix-up, which would make it a sfeik-sfeika, which normally would be mutar, over here we are in the sheet of Rabbi Yehuda, who believes that sfeik-sfeika is still a sur. So that's one way that the Baalei Tosfot deal with it. The second way they say is, even according to those that say sfeik-sfeika is mutar, maybe in this instance it wasn't that one from the first group got mixed up with the next group. Rather, all the parties in the first group got mixed up with the second group. And that's why it's not a sfeik sfeika, but a single sfeik over here, because it's the same sfeik that we had originally. Who is the shor niskal in this mixture? In the scenario before, it was a case where one animal was poresh from the first group and then entered the second group. Over there, you have a sfeik sfeika. You have a sfeik in the first group as to which animal is the shor niskal. And then we're not certain now as to the shore that left this group and went to the other group, whether they were the shore in Iskal, so that'd make it into a sfeik sfeika. So if you're in Shita Rabbi Yehuda, that would work. Otherwise, we have to say the entire group got mixed up with another group. So Tosfot says, then what's the chiddush? It's all one big sfeik. The answer is that you have trei rube over there. You have a double robe. Despite the double robe, the sfeik makes it that they all are asurim. But those are Rabbi Shimon Omer, mevinotan the beitin v'soklinotan. Bring them to Beit Din and we stone them. So you see the same machloket Tanaim over here as we're proposing that our Mishnah has, which is, what do you do in situations where you have a shor niskal that gets mixed up with other shvarim? Again, it's not batel. And since it's not batel, you end up with a mixture that is asur ba'ana'a. So there's no monetary loss anymore. You can't use them, can't utilize them anyway. So the only question is, how do we dispose of them? Do we do skila? Because if we do skila, we'll get at least one right, which is kill the one shore that deserves skila. but that's a huge tircha in Beit Din. But we want to do it because then Beit Din discharges his obligation. Or do we say that the tircha Beit Din is worth something, and therefore we just want to eliminate the shor? So biyarta mer mikibrecha just means get rid of all these shvarim and figure out the best way or efficient way to get rid of these shvarim. That's what we just suggested is the machloket in the Mishnah. First part of what we're speaking about in the Mishnah, when it says, Rutzeach shnitarei b'acherim kulan piturim, that would be the case of the chetz that yatsa b'nehem. And then we have the chesurei mechsera, which enters in the whole situation with regards to the shvarim, to which Rabbi Yehuda says, kuntzin otam b'kipa. So we're missing the section between what we first say in the Mishnah and Rabbi Yehuda's statement of kuntzin otam b'kipa. The first section speaking about human beings. Then we transition into animals, and on that, Rabbi Yehuda says, kuntzin otam b'kipa, and that's what we just noted over here. Imad shelo nigmar dina yalda, if before the gemar dina gave birth, vlada muteret, then the offspring is muteret. Way that we're reading in the braita that we brought before, it seems that the principle of ubar yerechimo is in effect, which is basically the child is an extension of the mother. So if the mother had a verdict that said they were a shor niskal, that verdict applies not only to the mother, but also to the baby, the fetus that's inside, because ubar yerechimo is like another limb of the mother. And so therefore, if the verdict is rendered against the mother, it's also rendered against the fetus. If the fetus is born before the verdict is rendered, then it becomes an independent entity. And so the verdict then is only against the mother, not against the ubar. Is that true? Even though when it gored and it actually did the killing, it was pregnant already. The question that is, wait a minute, when the crime was committed, when the animal killed someone, wasn't the animal pregnant? If the animal was pregnant, then why isn't the ubar considered to be a contributor to the death of the other individual? If you see ubar is yerechimo, then you would also think that the crime itself is also the responsibility of the ubar. As of right now, the way we're reading in the Braita, that would be irrelevant. The only thing that is relevant is the verdict. Was the baby born before the verdict or born after the verdict? The crime itself is not relevant. V'amar Rava, didn't Rava say, Vlada nogechet asur, the offspring of a goring animal is asur, because he v'vlada nagchu. They jointly were responsible for whatever death took place over here. As Rashi notes over here, Rava's statement, asur, he references the fact that you're not allowed to put on the mizbeach. It's obviously not about a hedjot, because if we're speaking about a hedjot, then it would be subject to mitah, and we wouldn't use the terminology asur. So it must be a situation in which we have an eid echad, or it's alpia balim, which makes the animal asur for hekdesh, but not necessarily subject to the mitat beitin. Vlada nirbat, the offspring of an animal who was subject to bestiality, asur, is restricted, he vlada nirbu, because the animal or the offspring was also part of the bestiality that was performed on this animal. Now over here you could differentiate, here you don't have to say that Rava believes that ubar is yerech imo. Could be that's what Rav is saying, that ubar is yerechimo, and therefore the ubar just becomes a part and parcel of the problem that's here, whether it's a crime that's committed and killed someone, or whether it was the victim of a crime that was committed against it, because ubar yerechimo, it just means that it's an extension of the mother, and whatever was done by the mother or to the mother is also true of the ubar. That's one way you could look at this and just see this all as ubar yerechimo, like the Braita. Although there is a possibility to view Rava slightly differently, which is that by the case of the verdict, it's clear that's ubar yerechimo. Over here, Rava might actually indicate that there's a contributory side to this. When the animal goes ahead and gores, we see the goring by the animal, not simply as goring by the animal itself, but also with the ubar. They jointly gore together. Now obviously the ubar is not goring, but it gives heft to the animal. It is contributory in helping or facilitating the goring that's going on. And same with the nirbat. We consider it as if it was nirbat. And Tosfot in Baba Kama goes as far as to say that the vlad, actually that's hana'ah from the revi'ah. Even if you don't say that it's ubar yerech imohu. So then, ema, so now the Gemara amends the braita to read the following. Ima chelo nigmar dina ibra. If before the verdict was rendered, ibra, it became pregnant, v'yalda, and gave birth, vlada mutar. In that case, the offspring is mutar. That means that the animal became pregnant after the crime, but before the verdict. So if that happens, then we consider the offspring that's born to be mutar, because the animal itself was not deemed to be asur yet. Without a verdict, it can't be deemed asur. After the crime, then it wasn't a party to the crime. So in that way, the blood is mutar. Im mishnigmar dina ibra, if after it was already deemed a shur niskal, meaning that it was going to be executed, then it became pregnant bialda and gave birth before it was stoned. If it doesn't give birth before it's stoned, then the animal and the baby are sent out to be stoned, meaning that there's no saving of the baby just because we're going to put the animal to death. Vlada asur. In that case, the vlad is asur because the shur niskal, which is asur ba'ana'ah now, gave birth to an offspring, which will also be asur ba'ana'ah. I mean, it's a derivative of something that is asur ba'ana'ah. As Rashi terms it over here, the nolad min ha'isur asur. Where it says, anicha l'man da'amar, that works well, according to one says, zev zeg gorem asur. When you have two inputs, one that is asur, one that is mutar, then we still say that the output or the result is asur. Over here, obviously the female party, the female animal over here is the one that is considered to be the shor niskal. But in order for it to become pregnant, it had to be mounted by a male that wasn't necessarily a shor niskal. Could have been totally mutar. That means that you have two parties contributing to the birth of this fetus. There's the male who's mutar, the female that is asura. So now maybe zev zeg gorem. These are two inputs, one mutar, one asur, giving you an output, a product or a result, which is the ubar. If you say that that's asur, then all of this works well. Because over here, the behima became pregnant after the verdict, but she was only one of the two contributing parties to the birth of this animal. On the other hand, elamandamar zev zeg gorem mutar, according to one who says that when you have two contributors, one mutar, one asur, that it is mutar, ma'ika lemeimar. How you can explain this braita now? Because you have two separate animals contributing to the birth of this ubar. So now, the way that Tosafot points out of here, nira dahad dechashiv le zev zeg gorem, hainu kamandamar choshishim lezera av. That's according to one who says that by animals, the father of the animal has impact. There is a view within the Gemara in Chulin that only the mother matters when it comes to animals. We're not talking about yichus anymore. We're talking about animals. So by animals, the only thing that matters is the mother of the animal. The male is just seen as a necessary prerequisite to the animal becoming pregnant. But we don't see the male as being a contributor in any sense to the animal. We don't see the fatherhood as meaning anything within animalhood. That's one view in Chulin, and that would have impact with things like Otovet, Beno. So Tosafot points out that this is only according to the Mandamar that Zera Av has impact. I mean, there's another Tana in Chulin that believes that there is such thing as fatherhood by animals, and it will have impact by the mitzvah of Otovet, Beno, by other mitzvot where the father has impact, and as well as in our situation here where Zev Zeh Goreim is mutar asur. The only reason you would think that the father is a goreim is if you believe that the father has impact halachically on the situation. Now, generally with animals, the mother or the female animal is the one that takes care of the young. The male animal is usually just a stud, is the one that impregnates the other animals, but he's not the one responsible for the rearing of the children, maybe for providing for the food or the protection, but not necessarily of the rearing of the animals. That is a unique difference between human beings and animals, which is by human beings, the concept of family means that both a mother and a father are involved with the rearing of the child, and that is really the chiddush of what Avram and Sarah do. Until that point in time, at least the Rav Soloveitchik wants to suggest in Family Redeemed, that the concept of family involved that a father was no different than the structure of an animal, which is that the father was just the way to produce the offspring, but they were not responsible for the rearing of the offspring. The chiddush of Abraham and Sarah is that they together will produce an offspring that they would jointly be responsible for, and the rearing of those would be together. And that's what Hashem says to Abraham. When Abraham says, I have an offspring already, Lu Yishmael Yechiel Lefanecha, and Hashem responds to him and says, no, you're going to have a child through Sarah. That's not enough that you have a child. It's that you are going to raise a child together with Sarah. And there as a family unit, you will produce an offspring that will be the joint result, not only just reproductively, but also through rearing and your raising of the child together. So again, if you believe that there is no such thing as zera av by animals, that is a unique difference between the way of human structure of family versus the animal structure of family. Again, there is an opposing view by animals that it does matter because the father does impact the output of or the offspring that is born. The genetics of the offspring are definitely contributed by the father. And so therefore there are those that believe that it is the case. But Tosafot is just making the point that over here, it's likely according to one who says Choshim Zera Av, although he does then try to be Mechalek and says maybe even according to the one who says we aren't Choshim Zera Av, it depends on the situation. Over here you have one that is Heter and one that is Asur. Maybe over here we would say Zer Zeh Goreim and everybody agree that the Zera Av has impact. The case where we say the Zera of the Av doesn't make an impact is where each one of them by themselves is Mutar. The problem is that the offspring together is Asur. We have Kilayim coming together. Each one independently is Heter, but the offspring is Asur. There, do we worry about Zera Av? Again, that would might have impact by Kilayim and be unique to Kilayim versus our case here where you have one that's Asur and one that's Heter. Maybe over here everybody says that the Zera Av is impactful. But either way, you have a problem now. According to one who says Zev Zeh Goreim Mutar, then why is this Shor Niskal who became pregnant after the verdict and then gives birth before they are sentenced, why is that animal going to be Asur? You have a father that was Mutar contributing over here. El Amar Ravina Ema Imad Shalo Nigmar Dina Ibra. If before this verdict was rendered, she became pregnant, V'yalda, then gives birth, Vlada Mutar. There the Vlad is Mutar, because there everything took place after the crime, before the verdict. So in that area, the animal is still considered to be Mutar. Ve'im Achelo Nigmar Dina Ibra. If before the verdict was rendered, she became pregnant, Ushemin Nigmar Dina Yalda, but then only gave birth after the verdict was rendered, Vlada Asur. Then the offspring is Asur. Rashi's wording is a little bit interesting over here. He says, "Im ad shelo nigmar dina hukar ubra," that the fetus is already recognized, or it's recognized that the animal is pregnant, which seems to indicate that it has to be visible that the animal is pregnant at that time, not simply that the animal is pregnant. Unless Rashi is just speaking from a practical standpoint, because otherwise, how would we know that the animal was pregnant before the gmar din? Elam kein hukar ubra. Given that maybe there was some flexibility within the gestation period, which would make it that we wouldn't be certain that it was pregnant before the Gmar Din, Elohim Kain, Hukaru Brad. It was noticeable that the animal was pregnant. Ubar Yerech Imohu. Because the child is seen as an extension of the mother, and that means when the verdict was rendered against the mother, it was also rendered against the Ubar, because the Ubar is just another limb of the mother. And in that case, even though it was impregnated before the verdict, after the crime, before the verdict, but nevertheless, since the baby was born after the verdict, the baby gets the same verdict as the mother, or is considered to be an extension of the mother. That's the conclusion of here, Ubar Yerechimo. And again, as distinct from possibly what Rava said before, which is that Rava could have not been saying Ubar Yerechimo, but simply that they are contributory, that they're both partners in the crime that was committed. But from this part of the Gemara, it seems the conclusion is Ubar Yerechimo. And that's what the Bali Tosafot say over here, Mashmash Ken Alocha. Because the Gemara doesn't then open that up and say, Hanicha Lamanda Amar Ubar Yerechimo, that works well according to one who says Ubar Yerechimo, and then go on to try to explain the other view. The fact that the Gemara doesn't do that shows you that the Gemara is drawing a conclusion here, Ubar Yerechimo, and wants to end on that note and say that is the Alocha. So Tosafot over here goes through many places in Shas, trying to determine if that really is the conclusion of the Gemara. And he shows that there is overwhelming evidence that the Gemara in many places thinks that Ubar is Yerechimo, and therefore it makes sense to say that that is the halacha over here, with the exception of one area of halacha. And he says here, everywhere in Shas, Ubar is considered Yerechimo, bar l'inyan treifut, except with the exception of treifa, shehu taloi b'chiyut, because that has to do with the life force of the animal, and the child is able to live independently of the mother. The fact that the mother is a treifa should not impact on the fact that the ubar is a treifa. Since the ubar is born and lives and survives, That shows you that it wasn't affected by the mother, or it has its own independent life force. Since that's the case, we won't deem it to be an ubar yerechimo for that one situation of treifa. So Tosafot says that generally ubar yerechimo, with the exception of the din of treifa. And of course, you have here, later on, way, way down in the Tosafot, he says, V'rabbeinu betam mefarish, b'chol duchtei kaimelan delabi yerechimo. Rabbi Deinu Tam disagrees and says that the Psak Halacha is just the opposite. That ubar lav yerechimo, so then all the cases that Tosafot brought that he had to answer now for the Rabbeinu Tam are proofs that the fact that ubar lav yerechimo, one of his problems is argument over here, which seems to conclude ubar yerechimo, and he says, behainu taimo, why over here is it different? Kevin darach shava yachyut avlad talui be'aim, hayavei ki'ilu nigmar din shnehem lahariga. Since the child or the ubar is dependent for his life on the mother, then it's considered to be as if the Gemara Din was rendered for both of them. The lav mishum davi yerechimo. Not because what the Gemara says over here that it's ubar yerechimoho, but rather because the child is dependent on the mother for its life, then when you render a verdict against the mother, you're rendering the verdict against the child as well. Not under the rubric of ubar yerechimo, but for that particular reason, that he's so dependent on the mother, there's only one life force jointly between them. As opposed to the view of the Tosafot, which is ubar is yerechimo, with the exception of treifa, because the definition of a treifa is that the animal will not survive. The fact that the ubar survived shows you that they are separate entities. And so here you have two different views within the Rishonim here, the Baalei Tosafot versus the Rabbeinu Tam, as to whether the Gemara's conclusion over here is binding the halacha, or whether this is an exceptional case, and the halacha is generally not that ubar is yerechimo. Kol chayvei mitot. So here we said that when you have all the chayvei mitot that get mixed up together, then we give them the lowest common denominator between them. Whatever is the lowest punishment that we have in terms of severity, we give that to everyone who is on death row, because in that way, nobody gets anything more chamor. We carry out the proper mitah for the one who deserves that. The ones who had a higher form of mitah, subsumed in that is the lower form of mitah. Right, says, Shvamina, mutra, the dabar chamor, avi mutra, the dabar kal. From this you see that if you give hatra'ah for a more severe case, that hatra'ah is valid even for the less severe case. Over here, we're saying that these individuals were brought to trial, sentenced to death based on a hatra that said they were deserving of sefila. They were warned, don't do this. If you engage in this activity, you are going to be stoned because you are violating Shabbat. They say, that's fine. I know that, and I'm going to do it anyway, despite the fact that there's sefila here. And that's the hatra that was given. Now, when you go to execute them, you're not going to execute them with sefila. You're going to have executing them with one of the other punishments. So that means that the hatra'ah that worked for the skila, we're saying is valid for the alternative punishment that we're going to give to them. Amar Rabbi Yirmiyah, hachim b'yaskinan. That's not necessarily true. Go and shitru bostam. It's a case where they gave generic hatra'ah. You will be subject to a death penalty if you do this. They don't specify the death penalty. They say generically a death penalty. V'hai tanahu, and it's this tana, right? Good question, which is, does everybody really think that? The tanya v'shar chayve mito shebe Torah. Other capital crimes in the Torah, eim imitin otan elo be'eda, ve'edim, v'hatra'ah. So this is as opposed to a mesit. When it comes to the mesit, we drop certain protocols. The truth is that they do need an Eda, an Edim. We do need a Beit Din of 23, and we do need witnesses. But what we do drop is the Hatra'ah requirement. We allow you to entrap, ensnare, or just hide Edim to capture the Mesit. True by Mesit, Mediach, Edim Zomamim, according to some, Iran Idachat as well, where Hatra'ah is not needed. So what they are saying is, the Shar Chayvei Mito Shebetorah, the other capital crimes in the Torah, you do need Hatra'ah. And you have to then identify for them the fact that they are now engaging in activity that will result in a capital punishment, a death sentence by Beitin. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, he says, you can't just say that you're subject to a death penalty, that you're going to be executed for this. You have to specify which death penalty they're going to be given for the crime that they are committed. What Rabbi Yirmiyah is suggesting is the Tanakhama is the author of our Mishnah, or the position of the Tanakhama is what is being used by whichever Tana is the Tana of our Mishnah, which is the fact that you can generically say that you're subject to a death sentence. You don't have to specify the particular mita. Rabbi Yehuda clearly disagrees with that. Tanakama yalif mikoshesh. The Tanakama says, I have a paradigm. Mikoshesh etzim in the midbar, they couldn't have given him hatra'ah for the particular mitzah because they didn't know which death sentence he was going to get. There you see that they gave it the generic hatra'ah, which is that if you go through this activity, you're going to be subject to a death penalty. And they prosecuted and executed him based on that. So you see that generic hatra'ah works. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, mikoshesh horat sha'ah haita. That the case of mikoshesh etzim is a horat sha'ah, was a unique circumstance. Now, you could say it's a unique circumstance just because they didn't have the information. So that's why it was a unique circumstance. You could even say that in a more detailed or finer form, which is that they gave the hatra'ah for all that they had at that time. What we demand of you is when you have the information, you must give the most detailed hatra'ah with the information that you have. In that time, the most information they had was Michalei Amot Yumat, that there is a death penalty. So they gave hatra'ah, they gave a full hatra'ah for all the information that was disclosed to them. Today, where you already know that the mitzvah is skila, then you have to give further hatra'ah because you have that information, that information is available to you. So that's one way to say the horat sha'ah, or you could just say it in a more generic sense, horat sha'ah, which is, over there, it was before they found out about the mitot. And since before they found out about the mitot, the hatra'ah wasn't necessary at that point. You can't extrapolate from that. You can't use that as a paradigm to learn from. So that's the machloket here between the Tanakama and Rabbi Yehuda as to whether you can use mikoshesh as a paradigm for determining whether hatra'ah can be generic hatra'ah, you're subject to a death penalty, or do you have to give specific hatra'ah, which is you have to specify the exact death penalty this person will be subject to. Tosafot over here raises an issue that he also raised back on Memhei Amud Bet, which is, we learned from the Pesukim back on Memhei Amud Bet that Beit Din has an obligation to carry out the death sentence and execute the individual who violated this crime. If they follow all the protocols and everything's in place, they have to execute them. We've here had a puzzle that says, how do we know that if you can't kill them with the mitzvah that is appropriate for them, then you're allowed to kill them in any way possible? I mean, there's an obligation on Beit Din to ensure this individual is put to death, irrespective of how they're put to death. So there the Gemara brought a pasuk to show that Beit Din is entitled to put the individual to death, irrespective of how they put them to death. So Tosafot over here asks, based on the Gemara that we saw back on Mem Hey Amud Bet, Ve'im Tomar, Ki Lo Avi Nai Mimutra LeDavar Akal, even if you believe that when you give the more severe hatra'ah, it does not help for the lighter form of punishment, here you should, Tipuklei Dechayav, you should still be Chayav in whatever mita that Beit Din can or is willing to mete out, because of what we said back on Daf Mem Hei Amud Bet, Sheimat Iyata Yechol Hamito B'Mitak Tuvapo, if you're unable to kill him in the prescribed capital punishment, Sharta Memito B'Chol Mito Shata Yechol, then you have the right to punish him in any way possible. So even if you say there is no hatra'ah over here, despite that fact, you should still be able to execute this individual based on the fact that Beit Din is enjoined to ensure that this person is put to death, no matter how they are put to death. So then here, even if you assumed that that hatra'ah for the chamura was not a hatra'ah for the kal, you still would have permission to use the kal because you have this right to kill the person any way possible. So over here, Tosafot does not answer it, but back on Mem Hei Amud Bet, Tosafot does note two possible answers to the question. The first of which is that the diuk of the Gemara is out of the fact that it says, kol chayvei mitot, any capital crime or any capital punishment, which means that even in situations where you don't have the right to give them another mitah, I mean, the Gemara over there is darshins it with bayrotzeach and gol adam, but there's certain capital crimes that don't have that ability. The fact that the Mishnah says kol chayvei mitot indicates that no matter what the capital punishment is, you're allowed to downgrade the punishment. So that would be a proof to the fact that if you have hatra'ah for the more chamur, that the kal is subsumed, otherwise you would not have the right to give them the lower form of mitah. Or Tosafot over there says boreach shiny, that over there the case is specifically about someone's running away from their verdict or running away from their execution, and so Beit Din has to then use whatever is in their means in order to execute this individual. And that means either because they're running away, or Rashi stated in one place that he was a mechashef and they can't get close to him or they can't kill him. So you use whatever means at your disposal to get rid of them. But that's a unique case. That's not the normal case. That's because there the person is actually not allowing us to do a v'yarta rami kirbecha. But in a normal case where it's v'yarta rami kirbecha and they're not running away, there maybe you would not be allowed to use these later forms of mitah when that trial was given for a higher form of mitah. Right now the Gemara continues and says, Aniskalim benisrafim. Says that those that were going to be stoned got mixed up with those that had to be killed through Sreifa. Matnele Rabbi Yecheskel the Rami Bray. So Rabbi Yecheskel was teaching his son Rami. Hanisrafim beniskalim. There were those that were subject to Sreifa that got mixed up amongst those that were niskalim, that were going to be stoned. Rabbi Shimon Omer, Yudono beskila, shesreifa chamura. Rabbi Shimon says that you give them all skila because sreifa is the highest form of punishment. This is Rabbi Shimon's sheet that we've seen many times, that sreifa is the more chamur, and that's what's said in our Mishnah. Amale Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda says, Abba, my father. So now, first of all, you know that Rabbi Yehuda's father is Rabbi Yecheskel, and Rabbi Yehuda's brother is Rami. So Rabbi Yehuda, who we know throughout Shas, the Rabbi Yehuda, which is Amar Rabbi Yehuda Marav, Amar Rabbi Yehuda Mashmuel, this is the Rabbi Yehuda. His father is Yecheskel, and his brother is Rami. So his father is teaching his brother Rami, and here Rabbi Yehuda interjects and says, Abba, lotit nehachi. Don't teach the Mishnah that way. He's basically correcting his father and saying you're teaching it incorrectly. My area, the Sreifa Chamura. Because based on the way you're teaching the Mishnah, it should be irrelevant that Sreifa is Chamura. Typically, the Ruba Niskalim Ninu. Just go after the Rove. As Rashi notes over here, meaning that even without the reason of Sreifa being more Chamur, you have a Rove of Niskalim, and that should dictate over here. Over here, you have a mixture of individuals, the Rove of which are Niskalim. The reason he knows that is because it says in the Mishnah, the way he did it, that the Nisrafim got mixed up amongst the Niskalim. The way you have the Mishnah phrased, you actually have the Niskalim being the Rove. So then why is it that Rabbi Shimon says over here, you know what the reason that everybody gets skila over here is because Sreifa is Chamura, you don't need to invoke that. It's because it's, we go Chim Achar Rove. The Niskalim here are the Rove, and we're going to follow the Rove in this case. So that's the wrong wording. Ella. So now his father says back to him, Hei Chiatne. So how should I phrase it in the Mishnah? Based on your suggestion, I would have to read it this way. A Niskalim ben Nisrafim. It's a case where the Nisrafim were the Rove, and then some Niskalim got mixed up with them, Rabbi Shimon Omer, Yudono Biskila, Shesreifa Chamura. Despite the fact that the Nisrafim are the majority, we won't give the majority punishment because it's more Chamur. And therefore we say you have to do Skila, even though they are the minority. That's what you want me to read? Yehoche Ema Seifa. Then what are you going to do with the Chachamim's position? Chachamim Omrim, Yudono Bisreifa. The Chachamim say, no, you get Sreifa, Shesreifa Chamura. Because Skila is the more Chamur of the punishments. Typically, the Ruba Nisrafim Ninu. Why did the Rabbanan have to invoke the principle of severity? They should simply just say, the Rove of the people here are Niskalim, and therefore you should give them Skila. Why are they saying anything about Skila being Chamura? You should give them Sreifa, because the Nisrafim are the majority over here. Why are you mentioning anything about Skila being more Chamura? It's just because the Nisrafim are the Rove, that should dictate over here. Where it says, Hatam Rabbanan Hu the Kamerle the Rabbi Shimon. So Rabbi Yehuda says back to his father, no. There, the Chachamim are responding to Rabbi Shimon's position. They're not the initiators of the situation. If they were the initiators, you'd be right. In this situation, they are, quote-unquote, saddled with the case that Rabbi Shimon started with. The case that Rabbi Shimon starts with is a case where the Niskalim got mixed up in a majority of Nisrafim. And despite the fact Rabbi Shimon says you give them Skila and not Sreifa, you who suggest that Sreifa is more Chamura, no, that's not true, Skila Chamura. But in Akanami, for us, over here we'd go after the Rove. The Chachamim in responding to Rabbi Shimon say, in your position, you are wrong. For us, first of all, its Rove is Sreifa, so then Rove would be the what dictates over here. Number two, even according to your reasoning, that the Rove is not going to dictate over here because Sreifa is more Chamura, that's wrong because Skila is more Chamura. So therefore, it's not a problem in the Chachamim's position. Over here, Rabbi Yitzchak and Rabbi Mordechai asked the Rabbeinu Tam, how come over here Rabbi Shimon doesn't just say that we go but the Ruba, the Chumrah? Because we find by Dini Nefashot, in the Gemara in the beginning of Chulin, says that if an individual murders a victim, there is a possibility that the victim is a regular person. It's also a possibility that the victim is a treifa, and we won't know. So do we go butar rov and say that the rotzeach, the murderer, is going to be brought up on trial? Or we say, maybe we're choshesh for the miut. If that's the case, then you can't put this person on trial because maybe the victim was a treifa. Over there, the Gemara in Chulin concludes that we go butar rov, and that means that by dini nefashot, we go butar rov the chumrah. So why doesn't Rabbi Shimon over here say the same thing, that we go butar rov the chumrah? And therefore, even when you have a majority of nisrafim that are mixed up with niskalim, we should give them the punishment of sreifa, because the hochim achar rov the chumrah by dini nefashot. Rabbeinu Tam answers, Tosafot has different variations of this in different places in Shas, but basically he says that there's a difference between a situation where we know the person is a murderer, and now the question becomes, are we going to put them to death or not put them to death? There we're going to go butt the robe and put them to death. In our situation over here, it's not a question of whether they are going to get a death penalty, just a question of which death penalty they're going to get. So over here, where the end result is that they're going to be killed anyway, then we're not going to go butar rov l'chumrah by dini nefashot. Because even if we don't go butar rov, they're still going to end up getting a death sentence, and it'll just be the lighter form of punishment. But it won't be that the person walks away from this offense without being punished at all. So that's why over there we would say butar rov l'chumrah, but over here we would not say butar rov l'chumrah. Amar lei Shmuel Rabbi Yehuda Shinina. So then, Shmuel says, either, there are different ways to interpret it. It's either read it, Rabbi Yehuda, Shinina, which is, he's saying to Rabbi Yehuda, Shinina, sharp one, Mr., that was his nickname that he gave him. Or it could be that his name was Rabbi Yehuda Shinina, which is that he had this name in order to identify him. We don't have surnames. How do we identify? Everybody is known as Yehuda. You identify them through a character trait. And so Rashi, some places in Shas, says Shinina means long tooth. That he had either large teeth, or he had large eye teeth, or some sort of fangs that he had. That's why he called him Rabbi Yehuda Shinina. Although more commonly, Rashi translates Shinina as being the sharp one, or the wise one. And therefore, maybe you would read it either as Rabbi Yehuda Shinina, that it's part of his name, or Amalei Shmuel LeRabbi Yehuda, where he says to him, Shinina, listen to me, smart one. Lo temalei lavuchachi. You don't say this to your father in that manner. When you corrected your father, you corrected your father improperly. Tanya, a person's father is violating the din d'oraita. Lo yomar lo, don't say to him, Abba avarta al divrei Torah. Dad, you're violating an isur d'oraita. Don't say that because it's not respectful. And as Rashi says over here, Jershum de mitzaf u'mitztayer, that you are embarrassing him and causing him pain. And as a child, that would be improper, that would be a violation of kibud av v'eim, and so therefore you can't address your father in that manner. Ella, rather you should address him in the following manner. Merlo, Abba, kachatu b'Torah? Is that what's written in the Torah? Is that what the Torah says about this? Presents it as a rhetorical question to his father, but he doesn't directly challenge his father. Gemara says, why does that make a difference? So, hainuach. In the end, you're saying the same thing. Whether you say to your father, you're violating what the Torah says, or you say to your father, the Torah says, and it's clear that when you're saying the Torah says, he's doing something counter to that statement of the Torah. So both of those are the same result, that you're embarrassing him and you're causing him pain. Ella, Omer lo, Abba, Mikra Ketuv B'Torah Kach, that the Torah writes the following matter. Now Rashi says, Minichuta. You say it not as a bitniah, as a question or a challenge towards your father, but rather you make it as a statement of fact. You're not saying to him, doesn't the Torah say? Because that would be the same as saying to him, you're violating an isur d'oraita. But if you just simply say, you know, we've once learned in the Torah, da 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 da, and you say it as a statement of fact, not as a challenge to the father, that is a better way to deal with it. And that's what Rashi says, Nichuto omer lo mikra amur b'torah. V'omer lo, Avi, Mikra kach v'kach ketuv b'Torah. We have a pasuk from the Torah that says this and this. Hu atzmo yisim alibo amazeh. He'll figure it out on his own. So the intonation of your voice should indicate a manner of respect. If you are directly challenging him the way that Rabbi Yehuda did, which is, Dad, don't do it this way, that's clearly problematic. Also, in a situation where you say, doesn't the Torah say? That's the same as challenging the father directly. On the other hand, if you do it in a, call it smoother way, which is you simply just mention, well, we once learned together this and this in the Torah, so it's not, in the intonation of his voice, it's not a challenge to the father, simply a reminder, say in their day, that to contradict a parent was a serious breach of the social mores, yes, to the point where it was totally unacceptable to contradict an elder, to contradict a parent. Again, today the social mores are different. It might have some impact on this halacha, although I'd like to think that it still should be somewhat enforced, that you have to be respectful when one speaks to their parent. Even when it's in a corrective manner, you still have to do it respectfully in order not to violate kibud av aim, despite the changes in social mores. That might allow us more latitude, but it still should not be that a person is doing it in a way that's an affront or a demeaning towards their parent. Should be done in a respectful manner. So in their day, that meant that there's a difference between contradicting versus just making a statement and leaving it as a reminder or a subconscious type of indication that maybe there's something wrong over here versus a direct challenge. And today, again, it might be just doing it in a respectful manner rather than doing it in a way that demeans or embarrasses the parent. That's the most important factor over here, is not to embarrass and not to demean the parent, because that would be a violation of kibud av aim. Okay, we'll stop here by the Mishnah on the top of Pei Aleph, Amud Aleph.